This is All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Another bustling week in politics. Here to review it are Rob Schofield of the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray with the conservative John Locke Foundation. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Jeffrey.
Since we last spoke, two more court decisions, neither going the way Republicans would have preferred. In a news dump last Friday, the North Carolina Supreme Court ruled that the State Board of Elections will go back to how it has been for a century, the governor appointing five people, as well as having local county boards reflect his party. The legislature had wanted to combine the election and ethics boards into an eight-member panel. Then, on Wednesday, a federal judge ruled that judicial primary elections could not be canceled, as lawmakers tried to do, at least some of them. Filing begins in less than 2 weeks. Becky, which is a more significant ruling, and why?
That's a tough question. I think they're both significant for a variety of reasons. If you just get to the policy implications, the canceling the judicial primaries, the Eagles decision this week, I think is important in that she kind of reset things. It was an interesting decision in that judicial primaries are still allowed for district court and superior court judges because the districts that they run in are still in question. And she said that is a legitimate reason to not have the primaries. The General Assembly made the right decision there as long as these districts are still up in the air. However, judges that were run statewide for Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, there is no need to cancel those primaries. And I think that it will make the ballots easier to understand. I think at the end of the day, when we're talking about all of these court cases, these questions that have been raised about election issues, I think that the key thing there is how does it affect voters? Not convenience for the system or the different bar associations or those kind of things, but how does it affect voters? Does it make it easier or less easy to vote to understand what the process is? So I think that the judicial primary election certainly was important. There are implications for the ethics board and combining the Board of Elections as well.
To me, it seems that there's been a sustained effort by Republican leaders to seize control of the electoral process in North Carolina. This is reflected in their efforts to combine the Ethics and Elections Board. It's reflected in their effort to do away with the primaries. I think Judge Eagles actually bent over backwards in saying to lawmakers, giving them authority to perhaps still cancel the primaries when it comes to district and superior court on this theory that they might pass legislation to change the districts, which is still very much up in the air. It seemed like she was being very generous to them. Clearly, the Ethics and Elections Board combination and the effort of lawmakers to basically take away Governor Cooper's power to enforce the laws and when it comes to elections, which it's traditionally been a gubernatorial power, by putting the appointment power with the legislature in effect, that would have been has been a tremendous sea change and would have contributed to the chaos we're seeing in elections. So the system we're going to go back to, it looks like, is one in which the governor will have more say over who runs the elections board. And I think that's a more logical result as to which ones. I think they're both equally important, though, when it gets down to it.
Yeah. And let me just add, too, on the ethics and elections board, the questions seem to be the appointments. The devil's in the details, as always. Who should have authority for that? What those appointments look like? Is one party have a more advantage than the other? But at the real question with it, or one of the questions is, does it make sense to have the Ethics Commission and the Elections Board combined under one umbrella? I think it does. And I think that was a good decision by the General Assembly. But again, then you get into who's making the appointments. What does that look like? Is one party advantaged over the other? I think that's where the real rub was. And that's what this decision this week was about.
The latest round of campaign finance reports emerged this week. In the second half of 2017, the GOP outraised the Dems by roughly $600,000. The Democratic Party, meanwhile, does report about $1.5 million more cash on hand. Biggest financial takeaway from the disclosures. Rob.
I think there were a couple. One is that it remains a very troubling story in North Carolina politics and in politics general, that the big cash comes in and it's about buying access for important for powerful special interests. So, for instance, we had a story this week on NC Policy Watch about tens of thousands of dollars pouring into environmental committees at the legislature right around the time they were voting on important environmental legislation, and that these were coming from polluting industries. And not surprisingly, they pretty much got what they wanted at the General Assembly. But the big story, it seems to me, was this guy out of Durham, this business person who gave millions of dollars personally to Republican PACs, to mostly to thing to campaign accounts controlled by Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. I mean, literally millions of dollars, far more than any other group, this one individual. And we're getting to the point now in North Carolina politics where wealthy special interests like this can just pony up massive amounts of money, effectively buy access to politicians in our state. I think it's a really troubling development, and it bespeaks again the folly and the error of moving away from public campaign financing, which is what we were moving toward in North Carolina, voter-owned elections instead of special interest-owned elections. I think it's been another sad development in what has been a sad story for the last several years.
Jeff, kind of two takeaways from that. One, the fact that the Republicans have raised more money should not come as a surprise to anyone. Power attracts money. When the Democrats held the majority in North Carolina General Assembly, they way outraised money for their campaigns over Republicans. So this is, you know, this isn't anything unusual. The fact that Republicans have raised more money shouldn't surprise anyone. On Rob's point about whether people ought to be able to give money to campaigns, I really see this as a free speech issue, and that we ought to be allowed to support candidates of our choice as individuals. If we want to combine our money into some of these other kind of PACs or other groups where, you know, the money comes together and decisions are made of what candidates you support, I think it's an important part of the process. I think it's an important part of democracy. It has been going on since the very founding of our country, and this is a form of free speech, and I think we should do everything to protect it.
I generally agree, but I do think it's gotten to the point now where when one person can come in and immediately and single-handedly give more money than everybody else, something's wrong. Something has gone wrong with our system, and it's simply, it can't continue this way, or we're literally going to have a plutocracy
where do you draw the line? I mean, you know, this person has free speech rights like everybody else does. And I would go back to that. The other thing is, you know, yes, money plays a part in campaigns. It enables you to go on television with television ad. It enables you to send mailers into people's home. It enables you to get your message out. But you've got to, at the very end of the day, you got to have a message that people are willing to buy. You know, Rob, I just would ask you, you know, how much money would President Trump have to spend in order to convince you to vote for him? There are some things that there's a responsibility to voters. In my mind, it's all about free speech, and we get to make those decisions.
Well, I used to be president of the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina, so I'm well versed in the First Amendment and free speech. I obviously support them with all my heart. But in this instance, there are ways to provide public funding that would give other people a chance to run for office and don't allow our campaigns to literally be bought and sold by a handful of plutocrats.
All right, a follow-up here. Who is Greg Lindberg? This is the Durham businessman who donated $890,000 to the Republican Party last year, as well as a cool million to a super PAC that supports Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. He's widely expected to challenge Governor Cooper in 2020. Oh, and $1.4 million to the Republican Council of State Committee, which Forrest chairs. This is a name to know, yes, not to sound overly snarky or cynical. What's he up to?
I think he's a businessman. He's a North Carolinian who wants to participate in the political process, and he has free speech rights just like everybody else does.
Well, he certainly, I can't dispute any of that, but I mean, it's clear that he has an intention to buy access to our politicians and to influence what's going on. And by all indications, it's to benefit the businesses he runs. I mean, he's not doing this because, as far as we can tell, because he just happens to be a true believer in any particular cause.
But we don't
know
that.
He's given money to Democrats in the past. This is about I don't buy the notion that this is all some sort of altruistic, you know, good government thing. If he wanted to do that, there would be other ways to do it rather than giving to dark money PACs. I mean, this is about buying influence and controlling the outcomes of elections, and that's just the way something we've got to move away from.
All right, Becky, let me interject here. Can you name someone for me who has donated millions upon millions of dollars for political purposes that you would deem altruistic, that didn't have a, you know, an ulterior motive or wasn't seeking some sort of access?
That's not a call for me to make. I mean, I don't know. That you would have to ask the people that donate that kind of money. All I know is that these people have free speech rights. They, for everything that we can see, they are operating within the parameters of the election laws that we have in North Carolina. They're exercising their rights. And, you know, for intent, I wouldn't begin to assign that to anyone. I don't know these people.
Yeah, nobody's saying that they shouldn't be able to. People should be able to spend their money however they want to spend their money. But there ought to be enhanced disclosure. We ought to know where the money's going, how it's being funneled to candidates, what those candidates are spending the money on. And there ought to be another way for people who aren't millionaires to also have an ownership stake in elections. And that, the most obvious way to do that is the way we've done it in the past through public financing. And it's worked very well. And we need to move back in that direction.
Public financing is taking money from taxpayers to go to campaigns that you may vehemently disagree with. The better way is, while there's nothing that says for any, there's nothing that says you can't donate money to any campaign, any candidate you want to.
My money right now goes to pay Donald Trump's salary. That's my public dollars. I wish it didn't go
there. And Nancy Pelosi's.
That's right. And I obviously, and that's the same thing with voter-owned elections. It's the election process itself that voters own,
not the candidates. And government pays for the election process. They should not be paying
the
for voter, candidates.
The voters own it.
WUNC is running a series this week titled Hitting Home, the Opioid Crisis in North Carolina. Listeners, you're encouraged to give it a read and or a listen. Two potential strategies to combat the epidemic that came up in my reporting for this piece: improved needle exchange programs and medical marijuana. Folks from both parties told me, quote, everything needs to be on the table, close quote, as it pertains to this issue. State funds for needles, legalizing medical marijuana. Would you support it?
Absolutely. It's clear that in states where they have medical marijuana, that there is a lower, that it has a beneficial impact on addictions in those states, opioid addiction. We need to treat these problems as public health problems. The criminalization hasn't worked. There need to be a way for people who are addicted to opioids to find affordable alternatives so they're not out on the street buying heroin. I mean, we need to treat it as a public health crisis, and clearly medical marijuana has worked in some places as a pain alleviation tactic that is not nearly so dangerous or addictive. To me, it's a no-brainer.
First of all, Jeff, great work on that piece, and I think you did an excellent job on really highlighting how complicated the problem is. You know, the two things that you've mentioned, needle exchange and medical marijuana, it may be part of the solution to the problem, but it certainly is not all of it. I mean, sure. And there's lots of players, there's lots of pieces to this. To me, and I don't object to a clean needle exchange or the medical marijuana. I think medical marijuana is way beyond just the opioids. I think that there's a need for it. There's been tremendous research. Other states have done it. So, you know, we're getting a lot of data that we can make that decision. I think North Carolina, because of political reasons, is pretty far from enacting it. But it's something certainly that I would encourage them to continue to look at, not just for the opioid addicted problem, but for lots of other issues as well. But I think this comes down to a mental health problem. And Rob mentioned the public health crisis. And I absolutely agree with that. I think that what we need to look at this is what it is, and it's a mental health issue. And what I would encourage lawmakers to do is to really, I think this is long overdue, is to really look at mental health treatment. It impacts our prisons. It impacts the safety. It impacts families every day. It impacts foster families. I mean, you know, the ramifications of this just go on and on and on. Again, it's a very complicated problem. I think at the end of the day, it's a mental health problem, and that's where we need to focus most of the resources.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch.